The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Grimm, online news editor of Science Magazine, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how mongooses transmit culture. I didn't know mongooses had culture, Dave.
Well, a lot of people didn't. And in fact, Rob, people usually attribute culture to more, shall we say, intelligent creatures like humans, primates, even whales and dolphins. Mongooses aren't traditionally thought of as part of that elite group of bigger thinkers. But this new study shows that mongooses, despite their small size and relatively small brains, do have as much culture potentially as some of their bigger brain counterparts.
What is the culture and how is it being transmitted?
Well, mongooses have this really unique social system where when the pups emerge from the den, instead of pairing up with one of their parents to sort of learn about how life works, they usually pair off with an older sibling or a cousin or an uncle who essentially becomes their escort or chaperone during their infancy. And this escort protects them and feeds them, even plays with them when they grow up. And part of this relationship involves a chaperone essentially teaching the mongoose how to obtain food. And in a specific example, and you can actually see videos of this on the site, a mongoose will say when it's eating a hard shell prey, like an egg or even rhinoceros beetles, to get at the gooey center, as it were, the mongooses will either bite into the item or they'll hurl it against a hard surface to smash it open, or they'll employ some combination of the two. But usually when they pick one method, they stick with that method through their whole life. And the researchers wanted to see when these pups pair up with their chaperone, do they learn the same technique that their chaperone uses? And that's what would essentially be evidence that culture is being passed from one generation to the next.
And this is happening in the wild, these experiments?
Yeah, it is. And the researchers actually watched 42 pups and their escorts over the course of several months. And what they found was that indeed, when an escort tended to employ one particular strategy for getting these hard shell items open, the pup would employ the same strategy. And even a year later, after the pup had long separated from the chaperone, the pup was still using that strategy, indicating that a piece of mongoose culture had been passed down.
So are researchers saying then that we shouldn't think of culture then as something that's only limited to big-brained animals?
Exactly. They're saying if these intellectually unspectacular creatures like mongooses can pass down culture from one generation to the next, that means a lot of creatures that we usually associate maybe with lower intelligence or just don't put on the same pedestal as we do with humans and primates might be capable of sharing culture as well. And after this study, scientists will probably be looking at a lot of other animals like this to see if they too pass down culture.
Okay, so what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from tracking culture to tracking mosquito slobber, this next story is all about how the spit of mosquitoes can be used to help predict major disease outbreaks.
Where are researchers collecting this spit?
Well, they're collecting it from traps that they set for mosquitoes. And these traps are essentially filter paper covered with honey. And mosquitoes like to eat sugary things. So what the mosquitoes do is they fly onto these traps and they feast on the honey. They tend to be very sloppy eaters, so they spread a little saliva around when they do this. And the researchers are basically trying to figure out, is there something in the mosquito saliva that will help predict disease outbreaks? The real problem right now is when mosquitoes carry a lot of diseases, they carry malaria and dengue fever and West Nile virus. And all these viruses present in different ways. Some of them tend to affect the same area over and over again. Some of them pop up in new areas. And usually by the time they've popped up, it's become a major health problem. And researchers are really trying to figure out with this new study, is there a way to sort of figure out, you know, when a disease is going to strike an area next. And that's why they were turning to this mosquito slobber. The idea would be that these viruses that these mosquitoes carry, the RNA in these viruses, the researchers might be able to collect them from the saliva that the mosquitoes are leaving on these traps or in the wild, maybe on a piece of fruit or other sugary substance, and be able to tell what disease might be coming.
So normally the researchers look at the mosquitoes after an outbreak has already started to happen in a human population?
Well, there's a number of ways they can do it, and all of them have problems. They can gather up mosquitoes, but as you can imagine, that's very time and labor intensive. They can take samples from people, but again, by then it's really too late. And so the idea is there a relatively easy way to find out what's coming?
So how much more efficient then are these honey-laced traps compared to these other traditional methods?
Well, honey has a lot of advantages. First of all, it's antibacterial. So when the mosquitoes leave the viruses and the RNA and these viruses on the trap, it's not going to get eaten up by bacteria. Also, these traps can be left out for more than a week, and they can be set over a really large area. They're speedy. They can be collected and analyzed very frequently. There's just a lot of advantages of doing something like this. And overall, these traps are effectively cutting in half the amount of time researchers would theoretically need to detect and respond to a disease outbreak.
Well, with all these advantages, is this going to start being employed all the time, everywhere?
Well, critics still point out that there's a cost factor here. It's not free, as you would imagine, to put these traps over a very wide area. Collecting them and analyzing them still does take time and money. So experts really want to make sure that this is going to be an effective approach before it's disseminated widely. And there's also the hurdle of convincing other researchers to adopt this technique. Again, the researchers are really going to have to prove efficacy in a real-world scenario to convince a lot of people that this new technique is worth trying.
Because the cost of conversion from the traditional methods to these new ones is also a consideration.
Exactly.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from mosquitoes that cause disease outbreaks to black holes that can destroy planets and even the planet-forming process, this last story is about powerful jets that are emitted from black holes and solving the mystery about why these jets form in the first place.
What are these jets?
Well, Rob, every massive galaxy has at the center at least one supermassive black hole. And these are black holes that can pack essentially billions of suns into a space no bigger than our solar system. And what happens is these black holes tend to spin around, and they have this so-called accretion disk, which is sort of a disk of matter that surrounds the black hole that also spins. And what researchers have noticed is that these black holes essentially spew these high-speed particle jets from their north and south poles. You can actually see a picture of this on the site. And the jets are essentially like cosmic tsunamis. They sweep away everything in their path for hundreds of thousands of light years. So anything that these jets are aimed at, even dust and the gas that normally would have congealed into stars, is essentially destroyed. And this jet is almost sort of like an eraser for the universe. Anything in its path is essentially wiped out.
Do all of these supermassive black holes in galaxies emit these jets?
No, and that's the mystery. Researchers know that some of them emit very powerful jets, some of them emit less powerful jets, and some of them emit no jets at all. And the question has been, why the discrepancy? Well, some theorists have proposed that the jets might be caused by the black holes rotating in the opposite direction as the accretion disks and their surrounding galaxies.
Is there any way to measure that in particular?
Well, researchers can look at radio emissions to tell which way a black hole is spinning. And when they did this survey of a bunch of the black holes that are out there, they found that black holes that were spinning in this so-called retrograde fashion were the ones that were producing the jets.
So opposite the direction of the rest of the accretion disk.
Exactly.
And so what then causes the different power of these jets? How fast they're spinning?
Well, the researchers actually trace this back to Einstein, and they say when the black hole is spinning in an opposite direction as the accretion disk, it has effects in terms of relativity and warping space-time, and it's creating basically these massive amounts of energy that are expelled as these very deadly and very powerful jets. And so the idea is those that are spinning less fast in relationship to their disks and surrounding galaxies are going to produce less powerful jets.
Is it the accretion disk itself that's slowing the black hole down?
That's what actually what researchers think is happening. What the researchers found is that in a lot of these younger black holes, and these are the black holes that are much farther away, the ones that are spinning in the opposite direction of their accretion disk are emitting the powerful jets, but that over time, the accretion disks exert enough force on the black hole to essentially slow down that spinning and reduce the power of those jets. And therefore, a lot of the much older supermassive black holes are not emitting these powerful jets as the younger ones are.
So the ones that are closer don't have these jets.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about how moons may still be forming in our solar system. We think of all the bodies in our solar system having formed billions of years ago, but it turns out there's some moons that may have formed even only a few million years ago. And also a story about the genetic basis of autism. Turns out it's a lot more complicated than researchers have thought. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about science education in the U.S. and how budgetary funding is affecting that. And also we're continuing our very extensive coverage of the oil spill in the Gulf. We're asking five major questions, including what's happening to the oil, what's happening to coastal ecosystems, what's happening to marine life. Be sure to check out all of this coverage on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.